ad nauseum with my friends who have certain opinions about people spreading misinformation about where autism comes from, what it means in society, and such things, and so on and so forth. So anyway, moving on to the weather here, and it is Burlington, Vermont, where we're broadcasting from here at WRUV. This is where the radio station happens at the Davis Center. And the weather for today, which is Friday the 16th, is going to be snow showers early, a low of 13 degrees. So people will call that chilly. I think most people will call that chilly. Tomorrow, there's going to be AM snow showers, high of 33 degrees, a low of 27 degrees. So it sounds like it's getting warmer relatively. On Sunday, it's going to be a high of 32 degrees and mostly cloudy, a low of 19 degrees. On Monday, it's going to be cloudy. 28 degrees is going to be the high. Low is going to be 14. As we normally do, we'll bring you right up to Tuesday. It's going to be a high of 20 degrees, a low of 10, and partly cloudy. So, best chance for sun until Tuesday is Tuesday. So, let's play you the public service announcement about bikes. We'll play you a little bit of a tune called The Wild Rover. This is Luke Kelly with the Dubliners. I mix in a little bit of Celtic theme music once in a while. I play a little bit of electronic music or house or other things. It depends what kind of mood I'm in. And the second hour we're playing, we've got another 20 minutes left on the lecture. And I'll mix in a little more music in between. And then, of course, what you're all waiting for is the commentary. Of course. And anyway, number here is 656-439. Any of your questions, comments, suggestions, all that. You can chat me at the chat thing we have on the website, which has been a little sketchy of late, but you should still be able to chat me at wrev.org. So chatbot, you can chat me on there and say, hey, way to go, or what the heck, or any of those related comments. So let's play the public service announcement about biking.
Running late to class, don't have time to find a parking spot, trying to cut down on your carbon footprint. If you answered yes to one or all these questions, then biking is the solution for you. Biking to class and from class every day can help improve your overall health and also burn some serious calories. Hopping on a bike and locking it up to a bike rack or convenient bench also cuts down on the time you'd spend looking for a rare parking spot on campus. Riding your bike also doesn't produce any harmful carbon emissions into our atmosphere, so Mother Earth will thank you in the long run. Bikes are also plentiful and affordable in Burlington, so next time you're thinking of hopping in your car to head to class or run downtown, consider riding your bike.
I wholeheartedly agree with this PSA. 100%. That was very enjoyable. And biking, I don't, my bike's not here yet. It's in storage. It's very sad. But biking in Burlington's great, even in the winter. I have a set of Nokia Hakkapeliittas, which I studied Nokia Hakkapeliittas that I have for my bike, which who knew that you can get Nokia Hakkapeliittas for a bike? That is pretty baller. I was very psyched when I bought them. They were expensive, unfortunately, as you would expect for Nokia Hakkapeliitta anything. But they do keep me, if you're right, I could ride across the lake on them. They're pretty awesome. And that was one of my favorite parts about when I used to work in Williston. I used to bike back to Burlington. It was like a 9-mile ride. It's like the end of your day. In the like, if you were stressed before you left, by the time you're done just riding your bike in back home, my stress was gone. Just kind of just, you know, riding your bike, you know, ringing your bell, ring, ring, saying hi to your neighbors as you bike by. It was a very nice, positive experience, unless you got, like, buzzed by someone that drove their car too close to you. That was the only stressful thing. Way less stressful than having to drive my car. So, highly recommend it. And my best bike, well, close to my best biking moment in Burlington was biking at the Intervale. It was like at night down by the Intervale. If you guys know the Intervale, you know, the little place where they do farming down by the McNeil generating plant. There's like a trail down there. No, go check it out. You should definitely check it out. It's real nice. Anyway, so it was like biking back there on a summer's day, and it was just like the crickets, and you're just biking back, and there were like fireflies. So I was biking through like just fireflies, just slowly zooming by me while I'm listening to crickets on this perfectly flat, like just like a little gravel underneath my bike on wheels. Use your imagination, people. And that was a great biking moment. If you want to live that, go buy a bike. It's pretty awesome. You can't do that in a car. It's just like, that's your experience on a car and killing fireflies as you drive by. It just be like, and the fireflies get all killed on your windshield. And that's completely different experience than having like fireflies slowly drift by you as you're biking, listening to crickets on the Intervale. So anyway, let's tangent. We'll play the music here. The Wild River, Luke Kelly and the Dubliners. It's an awesome song. I like it. So hopefully you will too.
I've been a wild rover for many a year. I've spent all me money on whiskey and beer. Let's sing a song. But now I'm returning with golden great store. And I never will pay the wild rover no more. And it's gold. I used to frequent. I told the landlady me money was spent. I asked her for credit, she answered me nay. Such custom as yours I can have any day. And it's so, nay, never. My pocket 10 sovereigns bright, and the landlady's eyes open wide with delight. She says I have whiskies and the wines of the best, and the words that you told me were only in jest. And it's no, nay, never. What I've done, and I'll ask them to pardon their prodigal son. And when they've caressed me as oftentimes before, then I never will pay the wild rover no more. And it's so, nay, never. No, nay, never, no more will I play the wild rover.
Let's get right back into the lecture. Ann Swindler, this is our 2012 sociology lecture. We kind of backed up a little bit so we can kind of talk about some of the tariff things she talks about and general context about that.
Economic policies that promoted development for the country as a whole. So you saw this very strongly in both Korea and Taiwan, that the government for one period imposed what was called import substitution development, which is they put huge tariffs or sometimes completely blocked imports of certain things, like in Korea, the cars. So basically, if you lived in Korea in the 1970s, you couldn't buy a foreign-made car. And that nurtured the development of Korean manufacturing This happened also in Taiwan. So very effective, strong government not only could pass these things, but could enforce them, right? Political institutions have to actually be able to build and wield power. You can't have effective political institutions if they don't have power. And these institutions had the power to impose these tariffs on foreign products that nurtured domestic industry. And then the amazing thing is when those industries got healthy enough, strong enough, big enough to compete internationally, the political institutions were effective enough to resist being captured by local manufacturing interests who said, we don't want, what do you mean competition? We've had this wonderful situation where, you know, we're the only car companies that can operate in Korea and no one can import Toyotas or Fords or anything else. And at some point, they forced their own manufacturers to compete internationally. And that is what allowed the development of these Asian tigers. So what Huntington saw is that you cannot have economic development without the development of effective political institutions. And in fact, Huntington argued, I don't know whether correctly or not, that one reason during the 1960s that in many ways communist regimes were very attractive to third world countries and liberal democracy, which we think is just by far the superior system, much, much, much better, were regarded with real suspicion. And it wasn't just because dictators wanted to keep being dictators and rake in the money. It was because we were offering no good theory of political development. We didn't have advice to give people about how you believe in strong, how you develop strong institutions, how you develop effective political systems. Why? Because we basically believed that markets regulate themselves. And that if you just export free markets and the ideology of free markets, development will happen. And Huntington saw that actually development can't happen. That it takes strong, effective political institutions to keep free markets free. Free markets require extraordinary levels of regulation, of monitoring, of preventing monopoly, of preventing corruption, of creating transparency. This is what, if you go right back to the first reading in the course, to Acemoglu and Robinson, that is exactly what they're talking about.
So I want to kind of talk about a little bit about tariffs in general. And so this kind of, like what she's talking about, kind of parallels the modern world, but a lot of the evidence points to certain elements of open trade, deals often with negative effects on industry that don't happen. They don't have time to adapt to new products or have enough capital to adapt quickly enough to the changes of new trade deals can bring. So this is kind of like I was talking about. We're making a case for iteration, and a lot of the time, a good example of this, I should say, is the changing of the trade tariffs in Jamaica. This is a good example in the U.S. And how it affected their agricultural products and their industries there. You can also sort of see this in Vermont, where if you've lived here, or have talked to people who have lived here over the last 40 years. Or even the last few decades, the dairy landscape has changed massively. Lots of smaller farms have disappeared, and what left tends to be farms that can afford the equipment or have the capital investment, the systems and the efficiency needed to survive the thin profit margins that are making from, particularly in Vermont, milk today. But let's kind of focus on the Jamaica example, because it's kind of really a good example of where the head rush towards neoliberalism, towards free trade, has didn't really pan out in the end for a lot of what people call quote-unquote developing countries. So anyway, So when the tariffs were lowered and all of a sudden, it really kind of wrecked the dairy industry in Jamaica. And it's now, they had problems with competing with large capital-intensive farms, and with capital that required, in breeding and large milking powers, with fast milking machines, large cool tanks to store the milk, the big tankers to move the milk, the large factories to process the milk. All these items cost a lot of money, and institutional know-how, how to set these up. And it takes people or institutions willing to take time and wait for the return on investment, which is often how these improvements are taken in iterative steps. So hey, just build a little bit of improvement, you have return on that investment from the improvement, and roll that back into making more investments and improvements that improve productivity. You make your own arguments against that, but this is their own arguments making about why a particular this works or doesn't work. So, like I said, in iterative steps, and once a mature interest that had time and capital is unleashed on a new market, there's no chance that the smaller company to thrive or survive when they have already someone that's already had that capital investment made over years and years and years, decades and decades, and have a productivity and can sell something at a lower cost. They're just going to roll over that industry in the often smaller markets in quote-unquote developing countries. And you could also see one widely cited numbers that the Jamaican fresh milk market shrank from 38 million liters to in 1993 to about 18 million liters in 2002. And imported milk basically displaced that market for lots of different reasons, but mainly because they not enough capital. And they're competing against someone that's already had the capital and the productivity. It will just roll over that market. And once you don't have the capital to reinvest into improving the market, it pretty much can annihilate the entire market. And you see that over and over in a lot of developing countries where we enforced capital-free trade deals upon them to have certain loan guarantees and everything else. And you really didn't see the returns on the investments that you were hoping. I should say that the argument that Ann Swindler is presenting, or I should say the argument that she's making from another sociologist, I'm not necessarily sure this is her own argument, she's just bringing up this particular topic. They're kind of really the government, having a government that's strong enough and patient enough to allow for space to improve takes time and stability, and allowing is not something that's a shock treatment, which is the norm of a lot of the OECD countries that can't enforce some of these trade deals. So in certain cases there where the governments are strong enough or there are industries that had capital enough to reinvest into their companies to improve them, they could weather that storm of free trade. A lot of countries couldn't. And so, yeah. You may be, I think a lot of the developed countries that are a lot of places where people are trying to enforce these rules on quote-unquote, of course, developed countries, as people like to call them, or they like to call it in 2012, in hopes, maybe cynically, maybe not so cynically, to help the overall productivity of the local industry. But others would say that bringing new markets to be rolled over, in all honesty. So it's like expecting a JV high school team will improve against 1986 Bears if they just had enough time to, compete against them. That's not going to happen. This is basically that JV team is just going to be either permanently demoralized or permanently injured. So that's the case for we're trying to make against that. So Anne doesn't necessarily make the exact argument in this lecture, but I think it's kind of a natural extension of what she's laying out. The objection that people always make is that, well, if there's demand, profit markets will supply it. But markets don't really respond to need. They respond to effective demand, meaning that people with money, effective demand, meaning people with money. You can't bleed capital from a stone. Stable investments like farming or housing, for example, either require good public investment or capital from all rungs of the ladder. And if the lower rungs don't have more money, you can't wring it out if the wages are flat or people are tapped out and the investment signal disappears. Capital doesn't always go where it's needed. It basically is wherever the capital actually exists. It also can mean it goes where the returns are easiest to see. It can also mean where luxury markets are, or might be chasing high risk bets for the next big thing. But it's not necessary through neglect. But because that's where the incentives kind of really shape the where money goes. Anyway, after stumbling over that, I kind of want to bring that back because we kind of want to, obviously, terrorism is a hot subject nowadays for some reason. I don't know why. And it's not always one-sided with free trade. You also see where we impose free trade on other countries without had really negative effects. And if you studied developing economies and investments, you probably know about this subject, but it's also a subject that's often not brought up in when you're talking about economies in general, because it's just kind of been free trade is good, markets are good regardless of, and regulation is always bad. And in general, when we've seen, we try to roll this out to different countries, you can definitely see where having some protections are valuable. But also saying, if you live in the world today, you could see where tariffs are kind of rolling out, trying to protect certain areas of the economy all of a sudden. So I think a more iterative approach, Bernie has argued for this for a while. He was against the trade agreements initially. This is not opinion of WRV. This is my own opinion. So this is not something that's been a new idea. But I think a lot of the people that, realize that a more iterative approach is where you'd probably want to go if you want to approach these systems, see where they're working, see where they're not working, and not necessarily bludgeon the industry all of a sudden. This is a good way to damage the economy in general. Anyway, that's just my opinion. Let's Anne talk about this a little bit more. She goes into a little more detail. I'm skirting along the lines of politics, which I usually try to avoid. But with this kind of last lecture, which we've kind of been pushing off, you kind of have to talk about it because it's obviously a thing nowadays. So let's let Anne talk about it, and I'll get off the mic. So keep on listening. Number here is 656-4399.
That where you don't have inclusive institutions, political institutions, you can't have effective free markets, right? So Huntington really was making the point that effective economic development really depended on political development, and at least the communists, whom he, by the way, hated. I mean, he was an anti-communist, a major, but he was saying, we're not competing effectively. We're not really offering a model of how you develop politically. They offer a model of a centralized communist party that can sort of govern all the way down. And right in the middle of both the conflict with Cuba and the Vietnam War, he was pointing to the superior political development of Cuba. So the U.S. kept trying to infiltrate Cuba to overthrow Castro, and we would send little groups of people who would land on the beach who were Cuban exiles. I mean, they spoke, you know, Cuban Spanish with no foreign accent. They were Cuban. And they would get spotted, reported, and turned in within days. Why? Because Cuba has an amazingly effective, it may be bad morally, it may be bad in many, many ways, it certainly in some ways has held their economy back, but they have very, very effective political institutions on the ground, so that every group of families is organized into 10 households, and those are organized into 10, you know, groups of households, and those are organized. And so everybody on the island basically is under some kind of supervision at all times. So the idea that somebody randomly lands on your beach and you're going to hide them in your hut and give them a base from which to make trouble for the regime, no, you're not. No, you're not. And so he made the point, and this was true many times over in Vietnam. He said that the North Vietnamese were organized all the way down. They used their Communist Party organization. It was a brutal regime, yes, but, you know, it was an amazingly effective regime. And it won. I'll just point that out. It won. And the South Vietnamese, he said the generals were afraid to leave Saigon and go out into the countryside because they thought that behind them some other general was going to stage a coup and take their command away. In other words, weak political institutions versus strong, effective political institutions. And so not good, bad, not nice, non-nice, but effective wielders of power. And I would argue that if you look at the world today, you will find that many of these post-communist regimes, which had effective centralized political power, are actually doing surprisingly well economically. So North Vietnam being one of the star examples. All right. Then I'm going to use one more really important example here, but I'm going to tie it to this diagram.
I think what she meant to say is counterexample. I don't think anyone's holding up North Korea as an example of prosperity, but that's what she meant.
So if you compare all the theories of power we've looked at, they are theories that largely focus on the inputs to the political process. That is, who has more resources to influence power, right? And that's power elite theorists. Who participates in decisions? That's the pluralist theory. So, and pluralist theory focuses on a bunch of really important things, like who can get organized to pursue their interests, what groups can mobilize, what's their capacity for organizing, the whole study of social movements. How did we get a civil rights movement with effective leadership that could sort of break down the barriers that were keeping African Americans out of the American political system? So looks at the input side, everything that helps people have power. And, you know, some people have a lot more resources than others. And that's part of that input side. I said Marxist theories actually do look at outcomes. So who wins? But what institutional theory focuses your attention on is this black box in the middle. And it says the kind of institutions you have determine how the inputs will be transformed into outcomes. And so here's where I would make a very general claim that I think there's good data to support this from the OECD countries, that is from the developed industrial countries, that the stronger and more effective your political institutions, however unequal the inputs, that is, some people are a lot richer than others, some people have a lot more, you know, control whole industries or have giant corporations or and other people are in small, despised minority groups or whatever, that does not automatically determine what the outcomes will be. And that, in fact, where you have stronger, more effective political institutions, the relative amount of, let's call it justice, that comes out the other end of the political system is greater. So weak political institutions leave the social inequalities that were the inputs to the political system.
And kind of cover it. this whole the whole basically show is now just referencing back to like everything we covered before. But you look at basically the strength of social institutions you see in government, they're usually highly correlated with how strong the social capital of a lot of societies are. So like the connections you have between how many social groups that you have, this is covered ad nauseum with Robin Putman's books and his studies, where you have basically the strength of how many small social groups that you have, grassroots organizations, really affect how corrupt those institutions are, how well they represent the people that they're supposed to represent, how effective they are at demonstrating power and not just necessarily acting in the interest of particular small vocal groups. So I think that's an important part, maybe a counterpoint bringing up to her example where she's pointing out where the places that had the best institutions were the places that were had the best economic development in those countries. But it's also connected back to grassroots organizations, which also ties back with inequality. It ties back with lots of different things. We've covered lots of different inputs to this. We also covered colonialism in general and how that's really kind of corroded lots of places around the world, their social organizations. And it's something we don't have time to cover because it basically took us a whole year basically to cover all these little small niches of talking about this particular subject. But the gist is inequality, social organizations like Rotary Club, or even bowling leagues, as Robert Putman likes to point out, are kind of like that solid base that institutions are built on. The institutions help build the government, which helps pay back to the people and make inequality possible overall for most people, which is a leading factor in violences in society in general. You can see that in historical record. So really, it all kind of ties together with sociology, and this is why we kind of want to cover it. This is why we're covering the subject throughout the year. So anyway, let's finish up with this. We've got another 6 minutes left.
Pretty much intact, or sometimes even exaggerate them. So these people had all the power to start with. You've got very weak political institutions. They directly appoint their brothers, their cronies, their friends to run whatever political institutions there are. And so the political institutions have one and only one purpose, which is to preserve the power of the powerful. Right? If you have stronger political institutions that actually have greater capacity to accumulate power, typically you also get greater capacity to modulate the effects of the unequal inputs to the political system and transform them into relatively, not completely, relatively more egalitarian outcomes. Now, these are the systems I'm talking about are all democratic systems. So one way to think about that is that those political institutions depend on voting. Voting is basically the egalitarian trump card, despite all the other inequalities. Okay, now I want to go to this Theda Skocpol argument, I guess, here, and see if I can get it in before the break, because it is a really fascinating, really important example of institutional thinking. And so this person's name is a funny, hard name to pronounce or to spell, Theda Skocpol. She's a sociologist with joint appointments at Harvard in political science and sociology, one of the most influential thinkers of her generation in political sociology. And what she pointed to was precisely this issue of the crucial role of institutions in both, well, in outcomes. And I'm going to give you an example from one of her papers. It's a paper that actually the title is in the earlier slide, written with a guy named Kenneth Feingold. And it's about the New Deal. And the argument they make is that during the Great Depression of the 1930s, you all know about the Great Depression, right? Yes. Both the industrial interests in the US and the agricultural interests were desperate to use government to help recoup their fortunes. And the way to do that during the midst of the Great Depression, they both saw very clearly, was to somehow restrict production. So, because what the situation they had was that in a situation of collapse, prices had fallen so low that it was generally not in the interest of manufacturers to manufacture and not in the interest of farmers to farm, because they couldn't be sure they could sell what they produced for more than it cost them. And competition kept those prices incredibly low because there were huge surpluses of manufactured goods, huge surpluses of agricultural produce, and consumers didn't have enough money to buy this stuff. So in both the agricultural arena and the industrial arena, farmers and industrialists pushed to have government help them restrict production, to drive up prices, to make it worthwhile manufacturing or worthwhile farming so that they could generate some income that would eventually support consumption, so create demand. And they tried to do this through two pieces of legislation, the National Industrial Recovery Act, NIRA, and the Agricultural Adjustment Administration. So the interests were the same. If you want to go back to that diagram about inputs, the inputs were the same, which is you had interested parties who dominated their arena wanting to restrict production. They knew what their interests were and they were pursuing it. They got themselves together. They got legislation passed. And the NIRA, the industrial thing, was a total failure. The industrialists agreed to restrict production. They agreed to set prices high enough to make manufacturing worthwhile. And then there was no way to really enforce it. They all got together. The government freed them of these antitrust laws that would have gotten in their way. And they went ahead and started cheating on this side and competing and lowering their prices. And the whole thing collapsed. The Agricultural Adjustment Administration was a tremendous success, and it actually set up the system of protections that we have to this day. Why? Because the agricultural arena in the United States had a long history of developing political institutions that incorporated and served agriculture. These were the people who distributed new seeds and new fertilizers and new agricultural ideas. So they were the Farm Bureau Federations, which had worked with the Department of Agriculture for generations. They were the land-grant colleges, like UC Davis and Berkeley, that had done research for farmers and that knew what was planted on every acre of crops in the every acre of land, farmland in the United States. And so you could do agricultural planning in America. And they did do it. And they offered people subsidies for producing less, and people produced less. There was no equivalent in the industrial arena. You can't do industrial planning in the US. There are no institutions that allow industrial planning. Industrialists have fought for generations to make sure no one could plan. No one knows what's produced by every industry. You could no more develop a general industrial plan for the US than you could fly to the moon. So institutions made the difference in whether these interested parties were able to get the outcomes they want.
And that is the end of the lecture series. We previewed the last lecture, 26. It's kind of just like a course review. We might toss it in, but basically this is where we're probably going to end. We covered this last semester on the show. I want to finish it up. Like I said, I started a new job, so I have not been able to do the stuff that I wanted to do over the break, which this is two Christmases in a row. I have like a holiday special talking about social organizations and Christmas celebrations and around the Yule time and how that has been happening throughout history and Christmas stories and music from England during the Yule time is all fun and exciting, that kind of stuff. And we missed it. You missed it. It'll be there next year. It'll be even better next year. Anyway, but I could always just do it after Christmas. But I'm one of those Christmas snobs that only does Christmas stuff like 2 days beforehand. So anyway, that's where I'm sitting on that. Anyway, there's an announcement here. It's a big circle. If you're interested in getting involved with WREV, it's community members and us students. It is student run, and most of the students that are here, high schoolers have been here. Max Resnick, the famous Resnick from NPR's son, was on here. He came here originally when he was in high school. I was a UVM student, and I came here after I was done with my courses. So everyone's invited. But the interest meeting is January 18th at 8 p.m. At the Billings Lecture Hall. That's right, January 18th, 3 p.m., Billings Lecture Hall. And as other DJs have mentioned, there's a sign right outside us. If you want to be this cool, come to the meeting. I wouldn't necessarily say what I'm doing right now is cool. It's definitely nerdy, which is kind of cool now, isn't it? I think so. I don't pay attention. Who cares? Let's play some music, because that's the end of the lecture, and the next DJ will be on. He's one of the fresh faces here at WRUV. This would be his first show after Graveyard Listen, because those are usually the best sets. People that just come on, pop on just right after. They're all excited. I'm excited to have them on. You should be too, so you should keep on listening. I'll be on next. But I'm going to play you some Fairport Convention, Million Dollar Bash. Is name of this track. I kind of doubt that title. I think it's something else. But anyway, it's from the great album on Half Bricking, who I found out from Mr. Richard Haggerty, who's on Saturday mornings. I highly recommend his show. He's a Brian Eno fan. That's how I'm a fan of his show. We're both Eno fans. He plays awesome music. You should tune in. You should be listening all the time, honestly. But you should particularly be listening to Richard Haggerty's show on Saturday mornings, who will be on tomorrow. So check that out. But in the meantime, this is also where I found out about this album. I love this album. I adore this album. It's great. I'm not saying you should buy this, because we can't tell you to do that. You can at least listen to it. I mean, at least, right? I mean, just listen to that already. It's amazing.
But why must you call me to tears? You're right around the eyes. You tell me things no one else hears. You spend all we'll be right back. must philosophize. But why must you fall into tears? Right around the eyes, you tell me things no one else can.
A girl cries in the early morning, woken by the sound of a gun. She knows somewhere somebody's dying beneath the rising sun. Outside the window of her cabana, the shadows are full of her fears. She knows her lover is out there somewhere, he's been on the run for years. Oh, the soul of El Salvador. The bell rings out on the chapel steeple, the priest prepares to say mass. The sad congregation come tired and hungry to pray their troubles will pass. Outside the sun rises over the dusty streets where the crowd gathers round. Flies and mosquitoes are drinking from pools of blood where his body is found. Of El Salvador, out on the ranch, the rich man's preparing to go for his morning ride. They've saddled his horse out in the corral. He walks out full of pride. He looks like a cowboy in one of those pictures the president made in the past. The peasants in rags, they stand back, for they know that Enrico gallops fast. Over the soul of El Salvador, a girl cries in the early morning, woken by the sound of a gun. She knows somewhere somebody's dying beneath the rising sun. Outside the window of her cabana, the shadows are full of her fears. She knows her lover is out there somewhere, he's been on the run.
Built above.
All right. Listen, WRUV FM Burlington. Oh, this is the last song I'll be playing. The next DJ is coming up. I don't know his name, but he'll tell you when he's on air. And just to give you an idea of what we've been playing, right now you're in the background listening to Sandy Denny within a song named Man of Iron. Before that, you're listening to Steel Eye Span with Lowlands of Holland, which you want from every Celtic, if you will, folk Irish song. I mean, the sea, death, and more death, and a lost lover. That's pretty much covers the bases right there. It's an amazing song. And I mean, that's like folk Irish bingo right there. You basically just won big time. And before that, you're listening to some Christy Moore, El Salvador. And that basically is the playlist just to wrap up the lecture. All great songs. I didn't have my full collection. I want to play you some Planxty, which involved the other bingo. Basically, murder of a jealous lover and sword fighting. That's pretty much what else do you want out of a song, really, with lyrics. And this is a great song, too, talking about. Well, I'll just let her talk it out. This is the last song I'm playing. I'll be back next week from 8 to 10. We'll be covering more topics. We'll be probably, I keep on telling you, I'm going to have more I'm going to have more people come on. But I was expecting I'll be in Burlington sooner. I am in Burlington now. There'll be more people on. Don't you worry. It'll be less of me talking, more other people talking, and me just nodding my head and going, yeah, that sounds cool. What about this? And then they respond. So that's the idea. And talking about social organizations from around town or locally. So anyway. Keep on listening to your better alternative. We got DJ, not dead air or automation. Yay. Everyone clap for that. Keep on listening.